This is Beverly Tomasian, and I'd like to welcome you to this online learning clinic preparing for the CDE exam. As adults, many of us have not taken an exam for a long time. So thinking about taking a written exam may be stressful for us, may cause anxiety, and of course, we really want to pass this exam. So I want to say a few things, and the first thing I'd like to say is just remember, studying for this exam will help you be a better clinician. It's going to increase your skills and your knowledge and really kind of broaden your perspective on diabetes. You may have to learn things that you really are not that comfortable learning. And I think that overall, preparing for this exam is just a good experience. So let's keep that in mind as we go through and talk about strategies for success. I myself take this exam every 5 years, and the reason I take it is I'm quite curious to see how the exam is presented, what kind of questions are asked, and I feel like preparing for this exam helps me improve my own clinical practice because I read up on things that I might be a little bit rusty on. So let's get started talking about strategies. Throughout this online course, you'll notice yellow underlines. These yellow underline words are links, live links to articles, resources, and other websites that provide more information on the particular topic. For example, if you click on this link, you'll see additional resources and articles for becoming a certified diabetes educator. The great thing about these online course presentations is that you could repeat slides and you can also skip them. So if you're already getting ready to apply for the CDE, you don't need to know about the qualifications. Go ahead and jump forward to slide 14. Maybe you've already applied for the CDE. You just need to get ready to take the exam. Then go ahead and jump to slide 17. Feel free to look around, get comfortable. This goal of this program is to help you just walk into that exam feeling the most confident you possibly can. In this web clinic, we're going to cover a lot of different topics, qualifications to take the exam, how is the exam formatted, what is in the exam, how do you strategize to study and succeed at passing the exam, so we'll talk about test-taking tips, and then I'll point you to some resources. I have flowers throughout this web clinic to remind you, think positive, relax, take a deep breath, and that will help decrease your anxiety, because as you know, anxiety stops knowledge. We want to be relaxed and able to pull information from our mind in that state of confidence. So those flowers are reminders to us of our feelings of calmness and confidence for this exam. I just want to clarify that my company, Diabetes Educational Services, has no relationship with the Credentialing Board of Diabetes Educators. That is, they have their own company and organization, and I have no communication with them. I have no insights into the exam. I'm just an individual diabetes educator working in the field, and really my main goal is to support your efforts to achieve your goal of getting your CDE and renewing your CDE. So I just want to let you know that this organization has a tremendously excellent website. They've really improved it over the years, ncbde.org. You can go there anytime to look at more information on the qualifications, the application process, and the content of the CDE exam. They are really a great resource. Taking the CDE exam can be difficult. There's a lot of preparation involved, and you have to get your qualifying hours. So what are some of the benefits of becoming a CDE? Well, definitely becoming a CDE does demonstrate to people with diabetes, your employers, insurance companies, that you have distinct knowledge and specialized knowledge in the field of diabetes. And because of that, you're going to promote the best quality of care for the clients that you interact with. So having the CDE is really an acknowledgement of your specialized expertise. It definitely also shows that there's a level of competence and training that you have acquired and achieved as a CDE. And additionally, given the epidemic of diabetes, we need a lot of CDEs out there, not only to work with people with diabetes currently, but I think CDEs also have a very important role in helping prevent diabetes, because I think that's where the future of diabetes education needs to go is looking at strategies for us to work in our communities in the public health setting to say, how can we prevent this very serious epidemic from getting worse? So certainly I think the field of the CDE will continue to grow over time. On this slide, I've listed the professional qualifications to take the CDE. As you can see, there's a variety of different healthcare professionals who are eligible. So I would encourage you to take a look at this list, and if you have any questions, go ahead to the NCBDE website for further information, or you can download their application. In addition to the healthcare professions that are qualified to take the exam listed on the previous slide, healthcare professionals with a master's in social work degree are also eligible. Once you meet the professional practice experience, there's other qualifications that are required to take the CDE exam. You need to have a minimum of 2 years to the day of professional practice experience in your particular discipline. So you have to get your licensure and work for 2 years under that licensure before you take the exam. And here's a big and additionally, you need to have 1,000 hours of professional practice experience in diabetes self-management education. And this is an important part here, with 40% or 400 of those hours need to be within the preceding year of the application. So the year preceding the application, you need to have acquired 400 hours of diabetes self-management training. This equals about roughly 8 hours a week. And additionally, 15 clock hours of continuing education activities within 2 years prior to applying for certification. So these would need to be courses recognized by the NCBDE as qualifying for continuing education. And as I mentioned, our courses do qualify for that. So if you sign up for any of our live or webinar courses, we do offer credit for those. The NCBDE has a narrow definition of professional practice experience. So if you're in the situation where you're trying to collect your 1,000 hours of diabetes self-management training experience, this is a very important slide for you. You must be providing diabetes self-management training within the United States or its territories within the past 4 years. And you must hold a job where you provide diabetes self-management training and you're paid comparably to other professionals in the same region. This is really important. So volunteer work doesn't count. If you're just getting a stipend like $5 an hour, that doesn't count. You have to have a title that includes diabetes education specialist, diabetes educator resource, something to do with that particular notion of being a professional diabetes educator and be paid comparably. Very important also, and we've discussed this one already, but hours are only counted after you complete your professional degree. So if you're waiting for your licensure to be processed as an RN or an RD, that doesn't count. Those hours won't count. It's once you actually get your official licensure in the mail, you can start counting those hours. So this slide is very important if you're working to collect those 1,000 hours to move you toward applying for the CDE exam. If you're working on gathering your 1,000 hours of professional practice experience, this is also an important slide for you. There are some things that are not considered diabetes education, such as diabetes-related functions performed as part of your usual job. For example, if you're a pharmacist providing pharmacy counseling to patients, and maybe a few times a day somebody with diabetes comes in and you provide diabetes education, those hours do not count. It has to be dedicated time where you provide diabetes education and you have a title that says that's what you are, like the diabetes pharmacy liaison, and you spend 4 hours every Friday and Wednesday doing diabetes education. The other thing that doesn't count, I've listed here, providing CE to professionals, supervising other professionals regarding diabetes. If you volunteer and do diabetes camp or you volunteer to diabetes, you know, community clinic, that doesn't count. No experience in a student capacity counts, and any committee work in professional organization also does not count. Other activities that are not considered diabetes education experience includes providing medical assessment, diagnosis, or treatment, participating in research, dispensing medication, promoting or selling medications or diabetes supplies and products. And lastly here, employment by manufacturers of diabetes products, and you're in-servicing other healthcare professionals about that. Or if you have somebody in your family with diabetes or you care for a family member with diabetes, these do not count. So really, just to clarify, it has to be a paid position. You have to be a diabetes educator or have a similar title, and you have to be paid comparatively to somebody else in your region. Once you get your 1,000 hours of experience, it's time to apply to take the exam. And you can apply online or you can apply by paper. And if you apply by paper application, you want to make sure and call the AMP Testing Center if it's been more than 4 weeks since you've heard anything. But if you do apply online, I'm sure most of you will, you will at that moment when you complete the online application get notice of approval or not approval, and you will be notified if you have been selected for an audit. Not everyone is audited, just there's a select group of people that are randomly chosen. And I'll talk about in a minute, if you do get audited, what paperwork you have to submit. So if you do get audited, this is what they will ask you to send in: a copy of your licensure, a documentation of professional practice experience. So this is important for everyone. As you go through and you accumulate your 1,000 hours, you want to make sure you keep track of your hours, how much you're providing a day, how much you're providing a week, and let your supervisor know that they will need to sign off to verify that, yes, indeed, you are functioning, providing diabetes education self-management training for that many hours a week. So it's really a logbook of your hours spent with a supervisor's signature, just in case you're one of those people who was audited to verify that they did accumulate those 1,000 hours and it's documented within the past 4 years. When I first took this exam almost 20 years ago, we used pencil and paper, but now the test is computerized. And the window to apply for the spring testing is January 15th through March 15th, and then you take the exam in May through June. Now, if you want to take the exam in the fall, you're going to need to apply July 15th through September 15th, and you take the test in November or December. This is really great because they used to have 1 or 2 days out of the year you could take the exam, and now you have a longer period of time to make the appointment and take the exam. So there's a lot more flexibility, which is really exciting. Once you've received your confirmation of eligibility, you're going to schedule that appointment with AMP Assessment Centers, and they're throughout the United States and internationally. And I would suggest to you strongly that you choose a place where you always have wanted to go. So you sign up to take the exam, let's say in Hawaii, take the exam the first day you arrive, and then the rest of the time you take a vacation. And if you have family or a significant other, you may want to bring them along too, because you deserve it after all that study and hard work. So what does a CDE exam look like? Well, it's composed of 200 multiple choice objective questions. You have 4 hours to take the exam, and it's based on a content outline developed from a job analysis. So every few years, they will set out and do a job analysis to find out, what do diabetes educators actually do? When the rubber hits the road, when we're sitting there across from the patient, what are we teaching our patients about, and what is the necessary skill set a diabetes educator must have to successfully provide diabetes self-management training? So looking at that skill set, it's very important to know that the questions are linked directly to a task or tasks. They just don't want you to know something. They want you to be able to apply it to a situation, to a task, to an individual patient. So therefore, each question is designed to test if the candidate does possess the knowledge necessary to perform a task or has the ability to apply this knowledge in a job situation. So a lot of this exam is going to be application of knowledge. That's very important. Another thing to know is that 25 of the 200 questions are new, but they're not counted in the final determination of your individual scores. So what this means is that 25 of the questions are just kind of trialing to see if they're well written and how people respond to them, and they want to see if those are test questions they would like to keep. So in truth, 175 questions are used to evaluate your score. So that's just good to know. I'd like to direct your attention toward the pass-fail stats for the CDE exam from 2008. And the thing I want you to focus on here is this first line. And that is, for candidates writing the exam for the first time, there's a very high passing rate of almost 81%. So you can see here that if you're in the situation and you're taking the exam the first time, to say to yourself, you know what, 80% of people taking this exam for the first time pass and do well. And with all my hard studying and attention to preparing for this exam, I'm going to be one of those 80% who also pass. So I want you to do a lot of positive self-talk to help increase your confidence and readiness to succeed with the CDE exam. Before we move on to look at the content of the exam, I think this definition of diabetes self-management is very helpful in giving you a framework of the exam. So what is diabetes self-management? Well, it's an ongoing process of facilitating knowledge and skills of the person with diabetes to help them provide their own self-care. This is really important, this next bullet point. It actually incorporates the needs and goals and life experiences of that person with diabetes. So as we're working with our patients with diabetes, we're always going to be soliciting from them. Tell me about your life. Tell me your experiences. What are your needs? What are you working toward? So it's not a goals imposed by us. We're going to work with the patient collaboratively. And this is all based on evidence-based standards. So we have good science behind what we're doing. And the overall goal with diabetes self-management education is to provide informed decision-making. So we're going to give patients choices and help them come to the best conclusion given their life situation. We're going to support positive self-care behaviors. We're going to work with our clients to help them problem solve. And very importantly, diabetes self-management education is an active collaboration with the healthcare team with the goal to improve clinical outcomes, health status, and quality of life. What's included in diabetes self-management education? Well, first of all, we're going to need to provide an assessment. This is very important. So we develop, based on our assessment, an education plan. And this plan is a collaboration between the individual and the educator to figure out what are the appropriate educational interventions and how are we going to support this person? What self-management strategies do they need to succeed? The educational interventions are to help the individual achieve their self-management goals. Additionally, we're going to need to do periodic evaluations to evaluate with our patients, were the goals met? Were they realistic? Do we need to change them in any way? And very importantly, we need to develop a personalized follow-up plan for ongoing self-management support. So diabetes education isn't a one-time thing. We're going to be working with this patient over a period of time to help them accomplish their self-management goals and provide them with ongoing support and resources. And of course, we're going to need to document in the education record and share our documentation with a provider of the intervention and plan that we've developed with the patient. Being familiar with the exam content is very helpful in preparing for the exam. It helps you focus your study time. The first thing I want to talk about is the assessment piece. And you can see the assessment piece has a lot of questions dedicated to it. And what they're going to cover under assessment is the following. That is, what are the person's self-care behaviors? So this is a moment you're sitting across from the patient, you're doing that individual assessment, you're getting their health history information, you're finding out their social situation, their knowledge, their self-care skills. This is a very important moment because it's going to help us figure out our next steps to take. So many questions are dedicated to this content because being skilled at assessment is a very important part of what diabetes educators do. So looking at the patient where they're at, understanding the different variables that are going to affect their behavior, whether they're social or cognitive, is very important piece of knowledge for this exam. So once we do our assessment, the next step is going to be our intervention. Intervention carries a lot of weight. You can see 112 questions dedicated to intervention. So intervention follows our assessment. And what we're going to do with our intervention is develop a team, a collaboration with the patient, with the family, the caregiver, the healthcare providers. How can we all work together to promote the best diabetes care possible? This is very important. We need to understand and recognize for real life and also for the exam that the patient doesn't live in a vacuum. They're within a social context and a healthcare context that we need to be aware of. I made this next one yellow because so many points and so much of the exam content is dedicated to this. Teaching and counseling our patients regarding the principles of diabetes care. This is the nuts and bolts of diabetes education. Now that we have the assessment, now that we know where the patient is, how do we provide information in a way that's usable, tangible, and effective to our clients? Using our knowledge of adult learning theory and different learning theories to make sure that we really reach to this patient to help them move their behavior in a new way. And of course, we're always going to recognize that we can't make patients do anything. This test is strongly focused on the empowerment model, where we provide information, skills, training, but ultimately we recognize that the patient is in charge of their own health, and they may make decisions that agree with us, or maybe sometimes they make decisions to do things differently than what we recommend. But whatever the case, we always need to honor that patient, their choices, and recognize that diabetes is a self-managed condition for the most part, and much of our role is as coaches, resource people, advocates, providers of information. So this is very important to keep in mind for this exam. The other thing that's very important is we need to recognize the importance of diabetes in a continuum. That is, we don't just see a patient once and forget about them. We understand that we are going to need to see them and follow up, adjust goals, make new goals, add another goal, because diabetes is not stagnant. It's dynamic and evolving. And that patient's life is evolving and their understanding and skill sets evolving. So another big focus of this exam is ongoing assessment, support, intervention, based on this dynamic situation of a person living with diabetes. Additionally, a lot of the focus is on the diabetes educator can't do it all. So who are we going to pull upon or call upon to provide ongoing follow-up? So are we going to pull in social services, podiatry care, dentistry, you know, ophthalmology? What other connections does this patient need to live the best life possible with their diabetes and prevent complications? So remembering that we don't do it all, we can't do it all, we need to refer out to others to support our efforts to improve care. Another important part of the exam content is program development and administration. And this looks to see how is diabetes education provided. How do we provide it individually or in group settings? Are we doing the right assessments to make sure that we're identifying our community and individual needs? Are we actually evaluating outcomes and quality? That's very important now with healthcare moving the way it is to show that we're making a difference in the quality of life, but also in clinical outcomes too. And also promoting the best care possible for diabetes. So advocacy is another thing that they're going to look at on the exam. And I do want to say, if you're not involved in setting up a program or in a recognized diabetes education program, I do offer a webinar called Setting Up a Successful Diabetes Program that I designed as a really excellent overview of what's involved in setting up a diabetes program. This webinar also looks at billing issues and it looks at outcome issues. So it's really an A through Z, which will help you not only set up a diabetes program if you're thinking about that, but really does provide you with critical information that will be very useful for the exam. When you receive your exam results, you're going to get two different scores, a raw score and a skills score. The raw score is simply the number of right answers, while the scale score is statistically derived from the raw score. And the scale score actually looks at the difficulty of each question. So simpler questions may be assigned 1 point, while more difficult questions may be assigned 3 points. So the total score determines the pass-fail and is reported as a scale score ranging between 0 to 99. So to pass this examination, you need 70 scaled score units. So that's what you're going to be looking for. And when they report out in the exam, they'll tell you in the different content areas how well you did in each one. So that gives you some good information about where you really excelled. And that was, it's good for you to know if you ever decide to take the exam again in the future. In the old days, it would take up to 6 weeks to get your exam results. But now with the computerized testing, you will receive your test results on the same day. Wow, that's exciting. You can take the test as many times as needed, which is really reassuring. You know, just talk to yourself before you take the exam and say, you know what, I can take this exam again if I need to. And that can also help calm you down and take a deep breath. The cost is $350 the first time, and renewal is a little bit less expensive. Questions: how do you choose the right answer, and what are some test-taking pitfalls that we want to avoid? I'd like to kick off with some of the pitfalls, and this one is common, that you race into the test question and you read it quickly and you figure out the answer quickly. But I don't want you to be a BMW motorcycle zooming in. I want you to be more like a VW bus, maybe in the 70s or something. Kind of slow getting in, kind of slow getting out. So you want to take your time. You want to really read the question carefully and look at all the answers carefully and slowly. So that's really important. Another thing you want to do is choosing an answer you didn't understand because the others seem too easy. So they're going to put distractor answers in there. Answers that maybe are very complicated or, you know, convoluted with a lot of big words. So they're going to tempt you to choose that, but it's not even the right answer. So don't be thrown off. Just look for the correct answer. Don't worry if it's easy or straightforward. That may actually be the best choice. Another really important thing I want you to focus on is looking for these words: always, never, most, probably, usually. These are qualifying words. They're going to be found in a question or an answer. So they're going to qualify, you know, the intent of the question. Look for these. Pay attention. Don't read over these. Very important. Another thing I want you to think about is choosing a good answer, but not the right one for the stem. Now, when I talk about the stem, that is, what is the key intent of the question? If you're reading, you know, the question and the answers and you're feeling confused, go back to the beginning and say, what are they really trying to get at? What is the key intent of this question? Very important to do. And then after you clarify the key intent, the answer oftentimes becomes more clear. So let me get back to this now. Sometimes you might choose a good answer. They're going to put juicy answers in there that seem right, but don't really match the stem. So again, they're going to put distractors in there. They're going to try and, you know, pull you into that answer. But you always want to think, what's the stem? Based on the stem, what's the best answer? So looking for the right answer to match the question. I've talked about empowerment in an earlier slide, and I'd like to bring this up again, and that is the perspective of the test is very important to keep in mind. And this test does come from the empowerment view, and that is people with diabetes are primarily in charge of their diabetes. We're going to function as coaches, educators, we're going to inform people, we're going to try and move them to action. But ultimately, we certainly need to focus on the individual and their needs. So two things that come to mind is that you may tend to want to focus more on the medical need rather than the psychosocial need. But don't be pulled into that. When you look at the vignette, you really want to evaluate, is this a medical need or is this person really struggling with grief, with alcoholism, with other factors that are not medically related but are more psychosocial in nature. So always keep that in mind, that as diabetes educators, we are not, you know, coming from the perspective of a doctor. We're coming from the perspective of a person who's trying to help promote diabetes self-management. So that's good to keep in mind. And the other thing is thinking about the patient characteristics and the different scenarios. They're going to tell you about the patient's age, what kind of diabetes they have, their social situation, and then they're going to give you answers. And they're going to give you answers that don't have to do with this particular patient's characteristics to kind of throw you off. And they might be really juicy answers. So just kind of ignore those and really evaluate answers that relate to the patient's particular unique characteristics. That's exactly what we do in our practice. As we're working with our clients and doing our assessment, we're going to find out about their social situation, their unique learning needs, what are some barriers that they're struggling with. And based on that assessment, we're going to provide a unique plan of action in collaboration with our patients. So keep this in mind, empowerment perspective, that people with diabetes are in charge of their health and are the ones that are primarily moving their health in that positive direction, and we're there to support and coach and inform. Some thinking pitfalls, and I'm sure you're familiar with these, but it's always good to go over. Looking for the right answer, which is not among the choices. So you may read a question and the right answer pops in your mind, but then you look at the choices and it does not appear. Don't let that throw you off. You're going to look at all the different possible answers and figure out which is the best answer, which is the best answer of those choices. So it may not match the answer you had exactly, so don't worry about that, but just choose the best answer from the choices. Another thing I think it's easy to do is overthink a question or overthink the responses. So really important, don't throw your own life experience into this question or the answer. Just use the information you have at hand, focus on that, and based on that, look for the answer that matches. Here's some other ones that I've kind of alluded to, choosing an answer that doesn't fit the situation. Again, they're going to put juicy answers in there to try and distract you. Just always look back to the key intent of the question. And there's going to be technical terms. They may throw in some big words to try and distract you too. But don't worry about it. Just try, as you're getting the key intent of the question, try and figure out the key intent of the answer. So, and then if you, you know, can break down that complicated word and figure out what it means, that's also really helpful. But the thing is, you don't want to be thrown off by these big words and different things they're going to use, as, you know, test writers will, to kind of distract you from the right answer. Work each test question. What do I mean by that? Well, what you're going to do is find the stem. What are they trying to find out, and what is the key intent of the answer and the question? Read all the options or answers. As I've mentioned earlier, something may pop in your mind, but you want to read through all the different options to make sure the answer you choose is the best answer. Of course, you're going to eliminate all wrong answers, and this I cannot emphasize enough. Select the best option. Sometimes you may feel like none of the answers are really right. They're kind of right, but not 100% right. And they're going to do this. They're going to have varying degrees of right in their different answers. So what you're going to have to do is say, you know what, it seems like there's two right answers here, but which one is the best option? So right is the first step, and then after you get to right, what is the best option given these different answers? Keep that in mind. That's going to come up. Don't let it throw you. You're going to just figure out, based on the intent of the question, what is the best option. We can look for clues in the answers too. If two answers are opposite or similar, one of them is probably right. Another thing is that answers with the following words, answers with these words, are usually incorrect. Always, never, none, only, must, and completely. These words are very black and white, and diabetes many times is not black and white, especially when we're dealing with humans and human behavior and behavior change. So usually if you see these words, they are going to give us information that that's not the right answer. Answers with the following words are usually correct. So here you can see they're not so absolute. They give us some flexibility. So these qualifying words usually are associated with a correct answer. Seldom, most, generally, tend to, probably, usually. So we can look for clues in the answers. Getting to the right answers. Don't leave any answers blank. If you're not sure, eliminate the wrong answers. It helps improve your odds. If you're just left with two questions, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it right. The other thing, there might be some math involved, so even simple math problems should be worked out on scratch paper. Because when we're anxious and excited about taking an exam, simple math errors are easy to make. So write it out, be sure. There's three types of test questions you will find in the exam. The first I've listed here is recall. Facts, principles, procedures. They might want to find out what is the goal for blood glucose levels. They might want to find out what foods contain 15 grams of carbohydrate. So pretty straightforward. You're just seeking information related to facts without a lot of gray zone, pretty black and white. The next we're going to run into here is application. So this means you have knowledge in your head. How do you apply it? And how do you apply it as a diabetes educator when you're working with different patients? And you're evaluating that patient's individual and unique characteristics. So this is getting more complicated, where we have to look at how the patient presents. We have to take knowledge and we have to apply that knowledge. So maybe we have an elderly patient living alone. They have to be started on sulfonylurea. What are some things we would need to consider given that patient's characteristics and what we know about the side effects of this medication? Analysis is the most complex type of question, where we're going to have to integrate or synthesize a variety of concepts or elements and look at complex problems with many variables. And this is actually what we do in real life all the time with diabetes. We'll get a patient come into us and they're going to present with medical issues, maybe medication side effects, maybe they're having autonomic neuropathies or other complication that's affecting their absorption. So kind of integrating that whole picture and analyzing the best course of action, looking at this patient's particular characteristics. So these are the most difficult questions, but you will see these on the exam. So don't be thrown off when they get complicated. Just realize they're just trying to evaluate my ability to apply my scientific and clinical knowledge in this particular situation. Let's look at some sample questions now and figure out the key intent and the correct answer. So our first sample question is, which of the following would suggest a diagnosis of new onset type 1 versus type 2 diabetes? So this is application. We're going to have to pull our knowledge to figure out, you know, what are the clinical signs of type 1 versus type 2 diabetes, and based on that knowledge, what would be the correct answer? The key intent of this question is very straightforward, type 1 versus type 2, new diagnosis. So there's not a lot of extra wording in the question to throw us off. Let's take a look at possible answers. A is hyperglycemia. B, polyuria. C, ketosis. Or D, polydipsia. So the first thing I'm going to do is eliminate wrong answers. That's going to be my first job. So let's take these one at a time, and this is what I would like you to do on the exam. Key intent, type 1 versus type 2, wrong answers, let's get rid of them. So first of all, is hyperglycemia the right answer? Well, no, it's not, and let's talk about why not. Because type 1s and type 2s both present with elevated levels of blood sugars. So that is a common feature of both of them. So that actually is not the right answer. How about polyuria? Do type 1s have frequent urination, and do type 2s also have frequent urination with new diagnosis? Yes, That's a possibility for both of them. So that's not true. Let's just go down to D, polydipsia. So they're using the big Latin words, you know, try and throw us off a little bit, but we're not getting thrown off by that. Polydipsia just meaning thirsty. Do type 1s and type 2s get thirsty? Yeah, you betcha. Now you may say to me the following, well, Bev, sometimes type 2's blood sugars aren't high enough to make them very thirsty or make them go to the bathroom a lot. And you would be right in saying that, but that's overthinking the question. Because what we want to find out is, what is a differential diagnosis? What is a thing that differentiates type 1 versus type 2? And you can imagine, since I have not gone over this answer yet, that it actually is ketosis. Ketosis is unique to type 1s because people with ketosis do burn fat for fuel because they're not making insulin. And when you don't make insulin, you don't use glucose effectively. You have to go to fat utilization for fuel. And when you break down a lot of fat, it leads to ketosis. So you have to know that there's a series of events that takes place when type 1 versus type 2 in the body that will lead a type 1 new onset to, yes, have positive ketosis. So this is the right answer. Here's a very typical style of question I would call a vignette style question, whereas they'll give you a situation with a patient and some very particular characteristics about this patient, and based on that information you're going to have to answer a series of questions. So I'd like to give you some practice looking at these. Read the following vignette to answer the next three questions. We have a 47-year-old man with newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes. We also know the following about him. He's married. He has two teenagers. He's a professor. He's obese. He started on metformin 500 milligrams twice a day, and his father died of kidney failure secondary to diabetes. So this is what I would call the unique characteristics of this patient, in addition to knowing that he's 47 with newly diagnosed type 2. We're going to keep these unique characteristics in mind to answer the following three questions. Based on this vignette, let's look at our first question. Given what you know about this patient, what emotions would you expect him to express? Fear of hypoglycemia, reluctance to start on insulin, panic disorder, or D, fear of complications. So let's go back to the question and find out the key intent. And the key intent is, what emotions would you expect from this patient? But they tell you something in this very first part of the sentence, and that is, keep his unique characteristics in mind. So that's a little clue. Given what you know about this patient, his unique characteristics, what emotions would you expect? Let's go through these one at a time and see if we think this would be the correct answer. So the first one is fear of hypoglycemia. Does that seem like the right answer? Well, let's think about his characteristics. Well, his dad had diabetes and complications of diabetes, but nowhere in that vignette do we hear that there was hypoglycemic issues, that the father had hypoglycemia, or that the patient has any issues to go along with hypoglycemia. And he's being started on a medication that does not even cause low blood sugar. So this is not the right answer. Reluctance to start on insulin, B. Is that the right answer? Well, this patient, we hear nothing about his father being on insulin or that the patient is threatened to go on insulin, and he said no. So although most people are reluctant to go on insulin, that's true. We get no information from this vignette that this patient is struggling with that issue. So that's the wrong answer. Could this patient have panic disorder? Would that be an emotion we would expect from somebody with newly diagnosed type 2, given the information we know about him? Well, we know, you know, he's a professor and he's got kids and he's obese, but there was no mention made of panic disorder. So this would not be the right answer. So that leaves us with one last choice. Let's just make sure it's the right one. D is fear of complications. Does that seem like a reasonable answer given the patient's vignette, the information about his father dying of complications, and his new diagnosis of type 2 diabetes? Yes, this does certainly fit the patient vignette and his unique characteristics. So we're going to choose D, fear of complications. This was an analysis type question, and what it asks us to do is to really, you know, look at, given the information we have, what emotions do we expect? So it's a little bit more difficult than a basic recall question. We had to give some thought to the patient's unique characteristic and his emotional response to this new diagnosis of diabetes. Here's another vignette question based on the same patient. What is most likely to be a potential barrier to lifestyle change? And it doesn't say this, but I'm going to add on in the back of our head, we're going to say, given this patient's unique characteristics and social situation. So let's take a look at the answers. A, is it difficulty exercising due to obesity? B, excessive alcohol intake? C, teenage children? Or D, long work hours? So think about that for a minute. What do you think would be the most correct answer? Well, let's take a look and eliminate wrong answers like we always do. And before we even eliminate wrong answers, let's look at the key intent. And this, again, is very straightforward. What is a potential barrier to lifestyle change? So we're looking for barriers here. Okay, A, difficulty exercising due to obesity. This seems like a very reasonable answer. I'm going to look at the rest of the question, the rest of the answers to see if another one is better. But I like this answer because I know he's obese, and I know that for people who are very overweight, exercise can be very difficult for physical reasons, and also people may be shy to go out and exercise if they're carrying extra weight. So I'm going to put a check by this right now, thinking, yes, this seems like the right answer, but I want to make double sure. Excessive alcohol intake. Is that the right answer? We don't hear anything about him drinking. We know he's a professor. We know that much, but we're given no information. It is true that if somebody drinks a lot, it's difficult to change their behavior. That could be a barrier. But in this situation, we're given none of that information to indicate he's drinking. Okay, let's look at C. He does have teenage children. Is that a potential barrier to lifestyle change? Well, I'm really not thinking so. It is true, being distracted by kids and maybe they have to go to different, you know, sport camps or activities, that might actually be a barrier to lifestyle change. But in this particular situation, we were not given any indication that that is the case, that his teenage children are difficult or they're causing him problems. So this would not be the right answer. Long work hours. We know that he's a professor. Professors do work long hours many times, but we don't know if he's working long hours. Maybe he's on sabbatical. Maybe he just teaches part-time. We don't know. We didn't get that information. So again, this would not be a right answer. So I think the key here is not to be lured into answers that are appealing, that look like they could be right, but don't match the patient's situation. The only one that matches the patient's situation is difficulty exercising due to obesity. Here's another question, vignette style, based on the same patient. And here we have the patient requests information about healthy eating. Which meal planning approach best suits this individual until he can see a registered dietitian? And here's our answers. A, 1200 calorie exchange plan. B, avoid all concentrated sweets. C, eat 3 meals a day with snacks in between. Or D, healthy eating based on diabetes food pyramid. So let's take a look at the key intent of this question. Which meal planning approach best suits this individual is really the key intent. And what they're also telling us is until he sees a registered dietitian. So this is done kind of as a stopgap measure until he can see the RD. So what is some good information we could share with him based on his unique characteristics until he can see the registered dietitian? So let's start with our usual, and that is getting rid of wrong answers. 1200 calorie exchange plan, would that be right? No, because the American Diabetes Association says not one meal plan fits all patients. So it is true in the old days we would give a tear-off sheet. Here's your 1200 calorie exchange plan, go forth and lose weight. But this is no longer the case. We need to individualize a meal plan based on the patient. So this is the wrong answer. How about this next one? Avoid all concentrated sweets. This is tempting because we may want to say to somebody, until you see the dietitian, avoid all concentrated sweets. But the American Diabetes Association does say that sweets can be included in the meal plan as long as they're counted as carbohydrates. So this is not the correct answer either. How about this one? Eat three meals a day with snacks in between. Is that the right nutrition information we want to share with this patient who's already obese? And in the old days, this would be, maybe kind of a standard thing we might say, but we realized that many patients following this advice were actually gaining weight because they were eating more calories than they need. So again, we don't want to provide a cookie cutter approach. We want to customize it for the patient and really kind of keep up to date with the latest recommendations by the American Diabetes and American Dietetic Association meal plan. So let's look at this last one, and that is D, healthy eating based on the diabetes food pyramid. Could that be right? Well, it's the best answer of all four of these. So we could, show him the diabetes food pyramid, encouraging him to eat fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, fiber, really focusing his calories on those healthy food choices and staying away from those foods at the top, the sweets and the fats. And as you remember, on the food pyramid now we have that exercise ladder going up the side. So this D is the best answer for this particular patient until he can be seen and provided with a more comprehensive, individualized meal plan by the registered dietitian. So I think this is a good example of choosing the best answer based on science and based on the particular patient situation. Our next sample question has to do with a medication called metformin. Let's read it together. Metformin is an anti-diabetic agent different than that of sulfonylurea drugs. Some features of the drug are that it A. stimulates insulin secretion and increases hepatic glucose production, or B. causes hypoglycemia, or C. lowers hyperglycemia in persons with diabetes but does not lower blood glucose levels in people without diabetes, or D. results in weight gain and increase in plasma glucose levels. So as you went through these answers, one of them might have stood out to you as right, or hopefully a few stood out to you as wrong. But let's just go back and look at the main intent of this question. And the main intent of this question is to find out some features of metformin. So they do give you some information here at the beginning. Metformin is an anti-diabetic agent different than that of sulfonylurea drugs. So it's a little bit, they're trying to give you extra information, trying to make it more confusing. But the real point here is that they're just saying, what are some features of metformin? That's the key intent of this question. And what I'd like to do is encourage you, if you want to spend a few minutes thinking about what is the right answer before I go through and, discuss wrong answers and right answers, if you want to put this on pause, just so you can have a few minutes, quiet moments to think about what you think is the right answer, I would encourage you to do that. Otherwise, I'm going to just go ahead and move on and eliminate wrong answers so the right answer becomes apparent to us. So A, stimulates insulin secretion and increases hepatic glucose production. Well, I'm just going to tell you that is the wrong answer because no diabetes medication would increase hepatic glucose production because that means blood sugars would go up. So wrong answer. Okay, let's go to our next one, which is B. Does it cause hypoglycemia? So this is where you need to know what medications cause hypoglycemia. And I would refer you to our diabetes medication pocket cards. If you feel like you're on a steep learning curve about medications, you can download those for free at my website, diabetesed.net. And I've also listed them as an attachment on my Diabetes University. So if you go to the Diabetes University, I have a webinar called Diabetes Medications, From Gut Hormones to Pancreas Pushers. And that is a really excellent review of the different diabetes medications, side effects, and considerations. And if you're thinking about taking the exam and this is an area that you want more study on, this webinar at our online university would be a great resource for you. So you would just need to know from memorization that metformin does not cause hypoglycemia. So this B is the wrong answer. Let's go ahead and take a look at D. I think I'm just going to go to D right now. Results in weight gain and increase in plasma glucose levels. Again, we know this is definitely the wrong answer, because what diabetes medication would actually increase glucose levels? That would be a very bad diabetes medication. That's the wrong answer. I've left C as the last one for a reason. If we look at C, we see it lowers hyperglycemia in people with diabetes, but does not lower blood glucose levels in people without diabetes. So this is actually true. Metformin blocks or slows the release of glucose from the liver. So it does lower blood sugars, and it doesn't work in people who don't have diabetes. So C is the correct answer. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Now that we finished talking about different types of test questions and eliminating the wrong answers and looking for the correct answers, I'd like to move on to study time. And studying is a very important part of succeeding with this exam. So as you notice here, I again have a picture of a flower that's going to remind us to relax, enjoy the process, and remember, you are accumulating great knowledge and information just by studying for this exam. So we're going to enjoy the process and find time to do it. This slide is really helpful in reminding me to tell you something very important. And that is, if you can work with the information you're least comfortable with and create a presentation of that topic. For example, maybe you don't work that much with gestational diabetes, but what you do in your study group is you say, you know what, guys, I'm not that comfortable with gestational diabetes. Let me put together a presentation, an informal presentation on what is gestational diabetes, how do we diagnose it, how do we manage it, and so forth. So the thing here is, by doing something you remember, involve me and I will understand. Not only understand, I will remember it. So I would always suggest to you, those topics you're least comfortable or familiar with are the topics you should spend most time with, and if you can, teach somebody about it. It will sink in and it will become much more available to you as you sit down to take this exam. Building your confidence is a key to succeeding on this exam, because confidence helps decrease anxiety. So the way we build up confidence is improving your knowledge of the content. How do we improve the knowledge? Well, you're going to study, you're going to read, you're going to talk to your patients, you're going to really be present when you're working with your clients and focus on their individual needs. And as you study and learn, your knowledge base expands. And as your knowledge base expands, your confidence grows. So what are some strategies to set up study habits to succeed? Well, one thing you want to do is figure out, when am I my best at my best as far as my mental ability to study? Do I wake up in the morning refreshed and full of energy and my neurons are firing? Or do I do a lot better at night when it's quiet, everybody's in bed? What is your learning style? Do you like to listen? Do you want to listen to books on tape? Do you want to listen to recorded information? Or do you really need somebody one-on-one talking with you, discussing things? When you study, do you want to be up, moving around? Do you want demonstration and workshops? Or do you like quiet time? So think about this. You know, we always ask ourselves to evaluate that for our learners, but what about for us? What is our most comfortable learning style? We want to set it up so we succeed. Set up a study space, a sacred place, space, time for you to study and say, this is special time for me. I want to succeed on this exam. And so every Wednesday night from 7 to 8 p.m., I'm going to go to my office or go to my room or sit in the living room on this chair and I'm going to study. And this is an appointment I have with myself. I know we're busy. I know we have a lot of commitments, but part of succeeding with this exam is setting aside some time for you to study. That increases your confidence, lowers your anxiety. And what we did is what we often do for our patients. We set up goals for them to succeed, SMART goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. We're going to do the same thing for ourselves as we move forward, setting up our study habits for this exam. You may be the type of person who likes studying with others. If so, a study group may be what you would really thrive in. And that is you get a group of your colleagues together who are going to study for the exam. You have an agenda. You set the rules. Okay, Joe, you do chapter one. You're going to do chapter two, Mary. Jose, you're going to do chapter five or whatever you want to, however you want to set it up. And you meet together and you say, okay, let's go. We're going to study together for an hour. Who's going to lead the session? And you make it happen. And I found that when I've participated in study groups, not only does it help improve my knowledge, but it really does help decrease my anxiety. And you get a lot of moral support. And of course, it can be a lot of fun. When you set up your study time, you want to divide it up in the following way. And this is so important. 60 to 70% of our time should go to learning new materials. And generally what I find is a lot of people want to study their familiar. But don't study your familiar. Move into those areas that cause you most anxiety. Is it medications? Is it gestational diabetes? Is it carb counting? Is it insulin therapy? Whatever it is, go there. Study it first. Because as you study that material, your anxiety decreases and your confidence increase. Other things you can do is attend courses that help you prepare for the diabetes educator exam. And as I mentioned, our team does provide live courses twice a year to help prepare you for that exam. But more importantly, our courses are designed to give you a great overview of diabetes education and really usable strategies that you can employ at your clinical settings to help improve outcomes. You might want to write up flashcards and take sample tests. I mentioned this before, teach your content to someone else. Put together a lecture and give it. Believe me, you will learn that material. The other thing that I have here is bring your study books with you in case you get stuck at the doctor's office or you know, you have to wait for something. It's a good time to do a quick 10 to 15 minute study. And sometimes those are the most effective sessions. Short, intense periods of study time are often very effective in learning one particular concept. Look at this gal. She's taken her exam. She's relaxing by the beach. She's so happy. And that's how you're going to look after you take this exam. How do we combat test anxiety? Well, we're going to keep the test in perspective. You know what, I can take this exam again if I need to. It's a great exam. I'm going to learn a lot of information just by studying for this exam. Positive thinking and affirmations, so important. I mentioned this earlier. 80% of first-time test takers pass. I'm going to be one of those people. I've studied. I've really put a lot of energy into preparing for this exam. I'm feeling confident. Positive thinking and affirmations decrease anxiety and help you access the information. Let's use those relaxation techniques we teach patients. Deep breathing, exercising, avoiding alcohol, you know, especially the night before the exam. A lot of fluids, you know, just all those things that we tell patients to do to help prepare for this exam. The other thing we're going to do the night before the the night before the exam is get a good night's sleep. Make sure you know how to get to the exam site, where to park, what you need to bring. Have your stuff ready the night before. And before the exam, you may want to socialize, or you may want to have just some quiet, thoughtful time to calm yourself down before you walk into that room. So you know what works best for you in combating anxiety, but here are some techniques that you might want to consider. I'd also like to recommend two books published by the American Association of Diabetes Educators, The Art and Science of Diabetes Self-Management Education and the Diabetes Education Review Guide. The Art and Science book is a comprehensive compilation of behavior change information, pharmacology, diagnosis of diabetes, and all the management aspects. This book will serve you well as you prepare for the CDE exam and will also be a tremendous resource as you continue your career. Our Diabetes Education Review Guide is a nice summary of the content of the exam, and additionally, it has 200 sample questions with the answers and the rationale for each of the answers. These resources are offered on our website at great prices. Just click on this link for more information. In addition to our online courses, we also offer a variety of live seminars. Our Level 1 seminar is a 4-day course designed for those who want to enter the field of diabetes education. Our Level 2 program is designed for those who are ready to take their CDE exam in the next 6 months to 2 years. Our team of experts has been teaching this course for 10 years. In addition to providing the critical elements of the exam, we really focus on your clinical practice and provide you with pearls and strategies to provide the best diabetes education possible. Our Level 3 program is Advanced Practice course, which provides a head-to-toe assessment of people with diabetes trying to find those undetected comorbidities or complications that are often overlooked. In addition, we offer a variety of online web clinics, and we're always adding new courses to our library. All of our courses qualify for CDE renewal hours since we are approved by the Commission on Dietetic Registration. Confidence equals success, and you are getting more and more confident every day as you study for this exam, as you read through different sample questions and answer them, as you listen to this webinar, you've discovered maybe some new strategies to succeeding at test taking. So you're going to walk into that exam room with a lot of self-assurance from all the work you've done to get to this moment. And you're also going to feel really great about all the knowledge you've acquired by reading, by your individual patient interactions, by talking with your colleagues. So this is a great moment for you. I'm proud of all you've done to get to this moment. And just keep in mind, I am going to do great. Thank you so much for joining this online clinic. Keep in touch. We'd love to hear from you. You can visit our website, diabetesed.net, for new and updated information, or join us on our Facebook page, where we post great articles, information, and offer promotions. Thanks for all you do to improve diabetes care. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.